The 15-minute city is an urban planning model which proposes that everyone should be able to access all services and basic amenities, work, education, the shops, within a 15-minute walk or bike ride from where they live.
That's Claire Heimer from Novella Media in Great Britain talking about the weirdness, the strange conspiracy theories that have arisen over the idea of a 15-minute city. That comes from Twitter. And once we get past the formalities, you can hear the whole of what Claire has to say on her Twitter message. Welcome to this latest episode of Climate Conversations. I'm your host, Robert McLean. This podcast is assembled here in Shepparton in northern Victoria, Australia, on the lands of the Yorta Yorta people. Yes, the stolen lands of the Yorta Yorta people. And I pay my respects to their elders, past, present and emerging. Let's listen now to Claire's Twitter message.
Wait. People are up in arms over walking to the shops.
This is the start of our freedoms being taken away.
It's for them to make money off of. It's for them to control us.
They've got a big plan. You need to do your research.
People are going to be totally controlled by the elite.
There's a new conspiracy theory in town.
15-minute cities are being implemented and ushered in by world leaders.
You will only have 15 minutes of freedom here in the UK.
Creepy local authority bureaucrats would like to see your entire existence boiled down to the duration of a quarter of an hour.
Be aware that someone is trying to make you smaller, control you.
The 15-minute city is an urban planning model which proposes that everyone should be able to access all services and basic amenities, work, education, the shops, within a 15-minute walk or bike ride from where they live. Its proponents argue that this would help to reduce traffic and create more sustainable, human-centric urban environments. These principles have gained traction in the UK, with a number of councils considering 15-minute city ideas. But some believe the model is a dystopian government plan to trap people in their neighbourhoods in so-called climate lockdowns.
Climate lockdowns are coming.
To save the planet from global warming.
Protests against 15-minute cities are growing, with a recent demo in Oxford drawing thousands, including many far-right activists.
We're a white nationalist group, but we're not protesting about anything to do with race or immigration. Today, we are protesting against 15-minute cities.
These protests are no doubt feeding off the same fears which fueled the anti-lockdown protests during the pandemic, when our freedoms really were restricted.
We're being taken over by what's becoming a totalitarian state.
We're in a prison here. People don't even realise we're in a prison.
But crucially, the protests are being backed by a network of high-profile climate deniers who are weaponising these fears in order to oppose climate action. What do you think about these protests?
Here's another opinion about 15-minute cities.
15-minute city is about nearness to amenities. So why all the guff about Stalinist prison?
This conspiracy theory is said to be an international socialist concept. It's also run by a cabal of capitalists. Bonkers! Conspiracists lie that the city of short distances is a concentration camp, a ghetto. Oh, grifter, 15-minute cities will not eradicate cars. Motorists will still be able to drive around Oxford. But from 2024, won't be able to rat run through the centre. 15-minute cities brand was done for Paris by this guy. But it's an old idea from 1960s time geography via 1920s neighbourhood unit. All cities were once walking cities. Even ancient Romans blocked four-wheel traffic. Once roads are closed to cars, almost nobody ever wants to go back. Newcastle's main shopping street was once dystopian, but not now. For true freedom, tame cars and boost walking, cycling and public transport.
Strangely, here in my hometown of Shepparton, we once had a pedestrian mill. I would say once. It was put in probably the 1980s, had been there for a long time. In fact, it was probably the oldest mill of its type in Australia. And just recently, it reverted back to having one-way slow vehicular traffic, and it cost about $18 million. And from my point of view, it hasn't improved at all, not one jot. This is the third offering in a 10-part video series from the newsroom in New Zealand. It's entitled Our Electric Future.
Of all the things we've got on in the sector at the moment, the three things which are probably driving the most activity, the first of them would be decarbonisation. As people probably know, New Zealand has an incredibly renewable electricity system. It's about 80% renewable. And what that means is that if you change a process from using fossil fuels to using electricity, you're making a huge reduction in the emissions from that process. But of course, that's going to lead to an enormous expansion of the electricity industry. It could be anything between a half and the same size again as big in 2050 as it is today, so doubling the size of the electricity industry. I suppose the second trend, it's just the sort of the end of scale economies, if you like. So electricity's always been about scale economies. It's been generating at very large scale and then transporting the electricity the length of the country through things like this. But of course, the economics of very small scale generation has improved immeasurably in the last 20 years. So now things like solar panels, in some cases, can actually be as cheap or cheaper than grid reticulated electricity. And I suppose that links to the third theme, which is democratisation. So consumers are increasingly wanting to have more active involvement in the products and services they buy. And combined with this changing economics of small-scale technologies with electricity generation and storage, it allows consumers to participate much more in the way in which they meet their power needs.
English reporter George Monbiot, who describes himself as an environmentalist, part socialist and part anarchist, says we need a new narrative if we are to avoid the worst of the climate crisis. It was in 2017 that he published a new book, Out of the Wreckage, A New Politics for an Age of Crisis, and he was interviewed by Claire Heimer from Novara Media. Here is a snippet of the interview now, and you'll find a link to the entire interview in the show notes.
Hello, I'm Claire Heimer and I am joined in the Verso London office by prolific author and environmental journalist George Monbiot. George, thank you very much for joining us on Novara Media.
Thanks, Claire.
So, you've just published Out of the Wreckage, A New Politics for an Age of Crisis. We know what an age of crisis, this age of crisis is, but what do you mean by a new politics?
Well, we're kind of stuck with, stuck in the long 20th century in a way. In that we still have 20th century economics, primarily neoliberalism, which failed catastrophically in the last century and in this century, but also Keynesianism, which worked tremendously well for about 30 years in the 20th century, but for various reasons hasn't got so much to offer in the 21st. We've got 20th century technologies, like thermal power plants and the internal combustion engine and hoisting people 30,000 foot into the air when you want to have a conversation, and factory farms and all this stuff. And we've got 20th century politics with our first past the post, strictly representative system, untempered by participation. And we are just desperately in need of a massive rethink, a radical transformation of all of that. And there is the opportunity now to do it because it's become so evident to almost everyone that the system is bust.
Now we shift to the New York Times for a story by Lisa Friedman. It has the headline, Administration to Approve Huge Alaska Oil Project on Monday, two officials say. The story begins, the Biden administration on Monday will formally approve a huge oil drilling project in Alaska known as Willow, according to two people familiar with the decision. Despite widespread opposition because of its likely environmental and climate impacts. The president will also impose sweeping restrictions on offshore oil leasing in the Arctic Ocean and across Alaska's North Slope in an apparent effort to temper criticism over the Willow decision and, as one administration official put it, to form a firewall to limit future oil leases in the region. The Interior Department also is expected to issue new rules to protect more than 30 million acres in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, from oil and gas leasing. And from the BBC, we have a story with the headline, Aramco, Saudi state-owned oil giant, sees record profit of $161 billion. The story begins, Saudi oil giant Aramco has announced a record profit of $161.1 billion. That's £134 billion for 2022, helped by soaring energy prices and bigger volumes. It represents a 46.5% rise for the state-owned company compared with last year. It is the latest energy firm to report record profits after energy prices spiked following Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. America's ExxonMobil made $55.7 billion and Britain's Shell reported $39.9 billion. The idea of 15-minute cities has been explored on The Conversation by a senior lecturer from the School of Nursing at the University of Wollongong, Christopher Patterson, and a research fellow from the AIC Centre of Excellence for the Digital Child, Lance Barry, from the University of Wollongong. The headline for his story is, "Forget the conspiracies, 15-minute cities will free us to improve our mental health and well-being." His story begins, "The idea of the 15-minute city, according to its originator, Carlos Marino, is that people are no more than a 15-minute walk or bike ride away from all the services they need to learn, live, and thrive. The idea is appealing in its simplicity. It puts people and the environment at the center of urban planning. It involves building new urban centers and restructuring existing ones to ensure the services people need for work, food, health, education, culture, and leisure are all close by, a walk or a bike ride from home. Key elements are the proximity of necessities, local participation and decision-making, community solidarity and connection, and green and sustainable urban living." From the Yellow Scene magazine, we have the story with the headline, "People Live in Cities, an Analysis of Urban Planning's Role in Loneliness." The story begins, "Technology and social media have allowed people to become more connected than ever. With the click of a button, an American teenager can laugh at a TikTok created by a German teenager. Yet, America is seeing record levels of loneliness. Where are these feelings of isolation coming from, and how can we solve them? For explanations, policymakers should turn away from the virtual and towards the physical. Recent research experience suggests that urban planning practices are quite literally dividing people. If urban planners build cities unsuited for socialization, then it is not shocking that inhabitants of these cities are lonely. Unfortunately, this is the exact position of contemporary cities. American cities nurture loneliness by hyper-focusing on cars to the detriment of alternative transport and neglecting the creation of quality public spaces." Let's listen now to ABC Radio's Blueprint for Living, where he talks about the 15-minute city. Here is the first part of Blueprint for Living, where Jonathan Green has a chat with Vancouver urbanist Brent Tedarian.
Here's a question for you. Who's afraid of the 15-minute city? You might be familiar with the concept. It's quite a thing in urban planning circles or just people who live in cities. The idea is a simple one. Your neighbourhood should provide residents with the basic things that they need in a 15-minute radius by foot or bike. It's a lovely idea. It's about urban amenity. However, not everyone is on board with this idea. It has become, curiously, part of the culture wars. In Canada and the UK, there have been protests against the 15-minute city. The claim is that it's a yet another tool of dystopian government overreach. Freedoms are being threatened. What is all this about? And how did the polite world of urban planning crash into culture war conspiracy theories? To help us pick our way through this possible minefield, we've enlisted urbanist Brent Tedarian. He's founding president of the Canadian Council of Urbanism and a former chief planner in Vancouver, city from which he joins us now. Brent, welcome.
Hello, Jonathan. Based on your introduction, I'm tempted to start by quoting a social media poster who said, you know, half jokingly and half frustratingly, "We're afraid of reasonable walking distances now." and it is a bit surreal. I've never in my 31 years seen it play out so aggressively on city planning, which is something that is sort of happening in the background of all of our lives pretty much all the time.
In those 31 years, the 15-minute city idea, when did that first pop up?
Well, it's been around for longer than my 31 years because, of course, we used to have 15-minute cities as the sort of norm. The idea that we had
them villages.
they call them good neighborhoods where you didn't have to get into a car for everything. You could walk to the corner store or you could drive to the store. You had the choice. But since the 1960s or so, we've deliberately, based on the advent of the car, eroded that. So we have a simulacrum of freedom where we think the car has provided us with freedom, but we're completely 100% car dependent, depending on the kinds of neighborhoods that we live in. You know, I'm not an anti-car guy, but I'm an anti-car dependency guy. I say we can't keep planning cities and regions where the car is the only choice, because that may seem like freedom to some, but it's kind of the opposite. Dependency is never freedom.
From the newsroom in New Zealand, we have the story, Putting Trees Back into the Urban Jungle. It includes the podcast, The Detail, by Tom Kitchen. Let's listen now to the early part of that podcast, and you'll find a link for it in the show notes.
Kia ora, I'm Tom Kitchen, and today on The Detail, I'm walking down a street in the suburb of Point Chevalier in Auckland, and just having a look at the trees that are surrounding us here, we can hear the yells and the sounds of residential life. We can hear the kids coming back from school, and the trees and the cicadas. And we can hear the birds as well. Just in the background here as we walk down, this is absolutely covered with trees, this particular street. Now I'm here with Erica Commers from Auckland Council. She works with the Urban Forests team. Kia ora.
Kia ora.
As we walk along the road here, do you want to tell me why we are here?
Sure. Well, we're here to talk about trees, primarily, and I chose this location because I thought it was a good representation of tree planting that has occurred historically in an older residential neighborhood. So you can see the difference in outcomes. So some of the streets have very sparse canopy cover, some of them have moderate canopy cover, and some have large shade tree cover, depending upon the species chosen.
So why does tree cover in our urban jungles matter? In Aotearoa, tree cover, or canopy cover as the experts call it, is pretty varied. In Wellington, it's about 30%, but in Christchurch and Auckland, it's below 20%. Local authorities are grappling with a big question. How can this be improved? Auckland Council wants to get its tree cover up to 30% by 2050.
Initially, when trees were planted in cities around the world, they were oftentimes planted and chosen and managed specifically for amenity value. But with the amount of research that's been conducted over the past few decades about the benefits trees provide to inhabitants of urban areas, and all of the ecosystem service benefits and ecological benefits, now we're starting to kind of see trees through a different lens and understand how much more they contribute than just amenity and how really important they are for human well-being.
Now we have a story from The Independent. It has the headline, How to Protect Your Homes from Ice and Snow. And the story begins, The Met Office forecast for snow across the UK and icy weather both pose a challenge over potential damage for homes. The Met Office has already issued a yellow warning for snow and ice, with more areas in the Midlands, much of Wales and the South East, including London, under alert for snow on Tuesday morning as Arctic air sweeps across the country. As conditions are set to worsen over the week, with thick snow set to cover several areas, homeowners could face large repair bills if they don't protect their homes, experts warn. Finally, we go to The Guardian, where we find a story by Robin McKee, the science editor. The headline for the story is, Scientists Warn of Phosphophageddon as Critical Fertilizer Shortages Loom. The story begins, Our planet faces Phosphophageddon, scientists have warned. They fear our misuse of phosphorus could lead to a deadly shortage of fertilizers that would disrupt global food production. At the same time, phosphate fertilizer washed from fields, together with sewage inputs into rivers, lakes and seas, is giving rise to widespread algae blooms and creating aquatic dead zones that threaten fish stocks. In addition, overuse of the element is increasing releases of methane across the planet, adding to global heating and the climate crisis caused by carbon emissions, researchers have warned. Links to all the stories mentioned in this episode can be found in the show notes. Yes, we've reached the end of this episode of Climate Conversations. Thanks so much for your company. It's been great to have you along. So until we talk again, please take care, stay safe, and please be kind. For everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. And please, if you enjoyed this episode, feel free to share with your friends. In fact, I'd love you to share with your friends, because it's my view that we're facing an existential crisis. This collapse of our global climate system demands that we face it with intent, knowledge, and purpose. So until we talk again, please take care.